Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Let's talk about happiness. There's a lot out there about how to be happy. Websites, videos, newsletters, you name it, all peddling a recipe for happiness backed by science. But my next guest, who is a neuroscientist himself, started noticing that a lot of that stuff wasn't quite as scientific as it could be. In fact, it started to bug him so much that he decided to write a book about it. Dean Burnett is a lecturer at Cardiff University and author of The Guardian's Brain Flapping blog, as well as a previous book called Idiot Brain. His new book is Happy Brain, Where Happiness Comes From and Why. Dean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks very much for having me again.
If you were to give our scientific understanding of happiness a grade right now, what would that be?
I'd sort of edge towards the C+ category. Like the gist of it's there. I think there's a general understanding of kind of how it works and the fundamentals involved. But a lot of the time it's severely oversimplified. And I'd hesitate to say actively so, but I think there's a certain intention to that. Because when you give people easy answers to what makes you happy, or you can be happy with these 5 simple steps, or this one key secret or tip, and that tends to give people false expectations and false hopes. And I do think there's a lot going on in the world whereby we expect to be happy constantly and almost by default, and that's not really how the brain works. So it's not too bad, but a lot of room for improvement would be my general assessment.
Let's actually take a step back and define happiness, because the idea, as you were just saying, of being happy all the time, maybe that we're always smiling and laughing, is probably different than if you were to ask someone in a broader sense, are you happy with your life? There's a lot of different ways to be happy.
Very much so, yes. I think some people say they're always happy, but I think what they mean is they are happy quite often, and there are lots of moments of happiness that they can think of. But if someone's constantly default happy, that isn't really viable. That's not really a useful way to be, because for one thing, happiness is an active state. It's something the brain sort of spends energy on, and it's used to sort of reward us for things that we've done, which the brain recognizes being good and positive and helpful. So if you're always happy, even when that sort of thing isn't happening, then that sort of really throws the understanding off, throws the equations off. You don't get happy in response to things which should make you happy. You're just happy anyway, and no opportunities there to learn. But I sort of learned throughout writing the book and doing my research that happiness as we use it seems to be like an umbrella term for all the different ways the brain can and does experience joy and pleasure and positivity and reward. And that is good. That's kind of helpful. But there are many ways in which to be happy. So if you look at the different ways like euphoria and glee, these are known ways in which people can experience happiness, but it can also be content and relaxed. But you seldom get people who are euphorically relaxed that doesn't really happen. You know, someone in an armchair by a fireplace with a glass of brandy, like screaming their heads off with the giddiness of it all. That doesn't really work that way. So there clearly are different things at work when we experience different types of happiness.
As you started your own exploration of the science of happiness, you kind of set out looking for a region of the brain that might be responsible for happiness or some of these happy emotions, much the way we have a region in our brain that's responsible for memory or a part of our brain that's responsible for speech. Why doesn't that work? Why doesn't that apply for happiness?
Well, I started off trying to see what could be, what could be seen as the most fundamental item or thing which supports happiness. So I started looking at even like the very chemicals, because you hear that phrase a lot, the happy chemicals or the happy hormones or the happy drugs and things like dopamine, and this idea that these things are intrinsically happy. Like if you were to get a bucket of dopamine and feed it to a cow, that cow would be extremely happy, and that's not really how it works at all, because obviously that's not how digestion works either. But so this idea that there are certain chemicals which are causing happiness and only happiness is kind of common. It's kind of out there a lot. You get lots of different articles saying you should boost your dopamine levels by doing this, that, and the other. And again, it's an oversimplification. Dopamine does many, many different things in the brain. Like if you want to boost dopamine levels, what you should do is get some medication used for Parkinson's disease, because that also boosts your dopamine levels, because in Parkinson's there's a degradation which causes a lack of dopamine activity in certain regions. But, you can say what you like about people with Parkinson's disease. Like, one thing they are not usually is euphorically happy all the time. So obviously it's more to do with than just raising dopamine levels. So then I thought, well, that doesn't work. Maybe there's a specific bit of the brain which leads to happiness. And if there is one, it would probably be the reward pathway, that fundamental circuit in the brain, quite small but deeply embedded and shared with many other different species, which allows us to experience the raw sensation of pleasure, positivity, reward. But it's altered with how this is activated, all the different ways it can be triggered and induced, and that's like where the human brain becomes incredibly complex. But things like fundamental processes, like the brief experience of reward, it's like a short-term thing, or like memory or vision and hearing, these are basic fundamental properties of the brain. With something as complex as a proper emotion or mood, that requires lots of different aspects of the brain, all different areas, networked together, working in certain ways at certain times in certain contexts. So the idea that there is one like lump of the brain which is responsible for happiness is, once again, an oversimplification and something which it does come up a lot when the brain's covered in the mainstream media, but it's something like neuroscientists try to urge people away from, because it does give them an idea that the brain is kind of simple and modular, when that's seldom how it works when it comes to anything more complex than a basic like sensory or fundamental function.
I'm talking with neuroscientist Dean Burnett about his new book, Happy Brain, Where Happiness Comes From and Why. So it's not just a matter of boosting the levels of certain hormones, you've said, and there's no one particular region that we're necessarily trying to activate, but it does sound like it comes back to experiencing the right types of things that trigger reward pathways on a regular basis. And you spend a lot of the book talking about what some of these different things are that seem to, for many or most people, trigger a bit of a reward pathway. And one of the first ones you talk about is home. Which, of course, I think all we have to say is the word home, and everybody kind of, home. We almost get a little bit of that reward pathway just saying it or thinking about it. What is it that's so powerful about home? Were you able to get to the bottom of that?
Yeah, it's an odd one, because like one thing you say, like experiencing the same thing, experiencing the things which cause happiness again and again, that technically should make you happy. But the brain actually adapts to anything which becomes too predictable and too consistent, because the brain learns. It learns that this thing is constant and regular, and if it becomes constant with no real change, then the brain sort of just adapts to it. Like when you get into a hot bath and you slowly but surely experience like it stops feeling so hot to you, or you put your clothes on, you stop feeling the material against your skin. Like the brain goes, well, I'm used to that now, so let's keep my resources, let's keep my attention focused on anything new and potentially challenging. And the same thing is true of anything positive too. So if you eat something, if you find a meal which you think is the most delicious thing ever, that makes you happy eating that. But if you ate it all day, every day, you would get fed up with it, quite literally, in every sense of the word. And that's, but then I thought, well, why doesn't that apply to our homes? Because our homes are such a big part of how we experience our lives. They're sort of kind of fundamental to how we navigate the world. And like the example I always try to use is like the Wizard of Oz, Dorothy, always saying, there's no place like home, there's no place like home. And nobody questions it, the fact that she's currently in Oz, a magical land full of fairies and magic and friends and robots and yellow brick roads, and people think she's a queen. And she wants desperately to go back to Kansas, a dusty farm plagued by tornadoes. And that seems like the lesser end of the deal to me, but she says that nobody questions that. Because everyone says home is really important.
Now, there are plenty of things about my home that drive me crazy, yeah. But take me away from home for 2 weeks and I'm quite happy to go home.
Exactly, yeah. Like the phenomenon of homesickness is believed to be an evolved reaction to being separated from your home and unable to return to it. A home seems to provide like a safe haven. It's like we like to explore the world and see new things, but it's a lot less stressful to do that when you have somewhere safe and familiar to go back to. And like our homes tend to not so much cause the happiness systems to kick in, but they also suppress the threat-detecting systems of the brain, the parts of the brain which cause stress and anxiety. These are very sensitive and very consciously watchful for anything which could be dangerous. And at the most fundamental level, your home is incredibly familiar as a place, and therefore your brain recognizes a place where you haven't died yet, and that's pretty good. That's quite a useful thing. So I've been here many times. At no point have I died. This place is safe. I can relax now. And that sort of shuts down the more active, nervous parts of the brain and allows us to chill. And that sort of is a big part of what makes us happy. Having this also gives a sense of privacy, which we crave. Just let the brain relax. The brain can relax in our homes, and that's a really useful thing for it to do to maintain well-being and happiness.
If we think about happiness in a broader sense being dependent on having these pleasurable or experiences that trigger the reward pathway on a regular basis, it seems like we could be going down the path of just hedonist. We should just be pleasure seeking all the time. But in fact, you found that work is an important component in happiness. So what's going on there?
Yeah, it's an odd thing because, you know, most people don't like their work. Like, so a lot of things, when you talk to people about happiness, one thing that often comes up is the work-life balance. That's a key part of happiness, having a good work-life balance. But even from that term alone, you can see how negatively work is often viewed. Because on one side of the equation, you've got life, your actual life. On the other side, you've got work, which is logically not life. So yeah, people treat work as a state of waking death. And it's really weird how often you say it to people, and often I said it, and they just nod at me and go, yep, that sounds about right. Because people don't like their jobs a lot of time. And a lot of things, like we need to work because we need the money. The money is how we survive in the modern world. The human brain is sophisticated enough to recognize that if I have this money, then I will be able to buy food and resources and shelter, all the things I need to stay biologically active and alive. And, you know, that's why we end up doing jobs we hate for long periods. I spent 2 years before becoming a neuroscientist properly as a cadaver embalmer for a medical school. And I wouldn't say I enjoyed that job. It wasn't my ambition to be handling dead bodies all day, every day and helping cut them up. But I stuck with it because otherwise I'd get kicked out of my house.
And then you wouldn't have the nice, relaxing sensation of coming home to home.
Well, exactly. Yes, that's how it works. But it's not just about the money, because work can provide lots of different things that the brain does like in terms of autonomy. Like the brain loves the sense of control. So if you have a job which offers you control and the ability to make your own decisions and affect things around you, that's often seen as a rewarding job. And things like respect and autonomy, we do like people liking us. So if you have a job which allows you to engage with people positively and they appreciate what you do, that tends to be, these jobs tend to score very highly on the happiness measurements. Things like doctors and engineers and even teachers, for all the stress that they get, they often score quite highly on the happiness measurements. But it's things which strip you of autonomy and respect and authority and status. These ones are often the worst jobs. Things like retail and sales and service industries and telesales. These are like kind of depressing jobs because they don't, you know, the customer's always right, therefore you're always wrong. If you work in these things, you have to be beholden to people who don't know as much as you, who are arrogant, who are rude, you can't do anything about it. And these are depressing, bleak jobs. They're often not well compensated, so there's no like reward there. And it feeds into the whole ambition thing. If you've got an ambition thing you want to do with your life and you have a job which helps you work towards that, these tend to be quite good ones. So if you want to be an astronaut and end up being a pilot, that's good. Like that leads you further and further towards your goal. If you want to be an astronaut and you're a barista, that's not quite as good because there's not a lot of overlap there. There's not really, imagine NASA aren't really fond of looking for your latte making skills. I mean, nothing wrong with being a barista, but if it's not your ambition, then it's going to be not as much of a rewarding job. And that's, these are all big factors which play into it.
You go through a number of other things that seem pretty logical, or at least, not unexpected, things like laughter and music and social ties. But then you also talk about, and you've already mentioned this, kind of the downside of trying to be happy all the time. What would be wrong if, in fact, we just went from a rewarding job to a great little afternoon with friends, with music and some laughter, and then a great dinner in a lovely home, and we're essentially happy all the time?
That situation there is it suggests a lot of varieties. And if you have the job that you like, if you have friends that you like, these are all good things. They are very rewarding, and this is all fine. Like, but I don't think between those things, it's perfectly fine to not be happy in a sort of noticeable state. So if you're on the commute from your job to your friend's place or whatever it is, you don't have to be happy then. It's like islands of happiness in a sea of not even like negativity, just normality. Like the brain's default state isn't necessarily happy, so it's okay to just switch off and disengage sometimes. You need to experience as wide a range of things as possible, and that includes emotions. Like the brain has systems in place to experience a full suite of emotions. If you only focus on one, it's like working on only one muscle in the gym. Like you work on your left leg muscle, that's great. Then you've got one massive leg and the rest of your body's all out of proportion and you find it hard to function. I mean, it's imagine it'd be hilarious to look at, but it doesn't do you many favours.
My guest is neuroscientist Dean Burnett. He's author of Happy Brain, Where Happiness Comes From and Why. Did you get a sense from your research of whether as a modern society, if we can even say we're all one society, are we happier, sadder than we used to be, more aware or obsessed with the idea of happiness than we used to be?
There does seem to be a shift towards this idea that you have to be happy. You have to be happy all the time. And if you're not, then there's something amiss. And I think part of this comes from it being a capitalist culture, a very individualistic culture, and you know, aspirational things. You're constantly bombarded by media and commercials where people have all the best stuff and they seem so happy and giddy and glowing. And you're supposed to want that. You're supposed to want to be that. And that suggests that a certain default happiness is the end goal, which is kind of unhelpful. There's also the cultural cliches of, you know, if you find someone, you live happily ever after. And that's, you know, like the idea that one thing can happen, this in this case, a relationship or a long-term partner, you find them and you're always happy from that point on. And that's, again, a misleading idea of how the brain works. And I do think, you know, I'm not saying necessarily good or bad, but I do think social networks have really sort of accelerated this in that now it's constantly, if you're part of a social network, you're invariably surrounded by people who, because the brain is kind of predisposed to present the best image of yourself to the outside world, because they're a very social species, you want to be liked by default by people we value and care about or identify with. So you put yourself on social network, you have far more control over how you come across, and you've got to present yourself as more happy and upbeat. And the people who are constantly moaning online or miserable, they tend to be shunned or tend to be like, you know, criticized for that. Mm-hmm. And the things about couples always posting happy, lovey-dovey pictures. And so if you go on social networks like Instagram or Facebook or even Twitter sometimes, it's like you see people like, oh, everyone's so happy all the time. They're very much in love. They have a lovely holiday. Look at their lunch. It looks glorious. And that is reinforcing this idea that everyone's happy. And because we want to fit in, because we judge ourselves by how other people in their lives, it does give this sense that we should be happy. And if we're not, there must be something wrong, which isn't the case, really. That's, you know, that's perfectly normal to not be happy.
What do you hope that people will take away from your book? Because you're pretty explicit that you're not trying to write a self-help book. You're not trying to put out one more of these oversimplified recipes for happiness. So what do you want people to get from it?
I think if there was something I'd like people to take away, it's like a two-pronged thing. One would be fine, but two would be ideal. It's that happiness is really complicated, like anything to do with the brain. And once again, like these quick fix solutions, these simple ideas that it's all a matter of just doing two or three things or just making this one minor change to your life and then you'll be happy. That's invariably wrong. It might be the case for you, but it won't be the case for everyone because the brain varies so much from person to person. And I think it's not a self-help book, but people have said, well, I could use it as one. But yes, you could, definitely. But I don't tell anyone what to do with their lives. That's where I sort of differentiate myself from all that sort of approach. Because I don't know the reader. I don't know what their life's like. I don't know what's going on in it. I don't know how they feel or what they think about things. So what I want to do is just put the vocabulary out there, put the details out there. Like, here's how the brain handles happiness. How you want to use this information is entirely up to you, but now you've got it to do with what you will. And that's sort of my approach to pretty much anything I write, really. I never tell anyone what to do with their lives. I can't fix you. I don't know you, but I can provide you some tools. Maybe you could, you know, make some changes of your own volition and sort of look at things from your own perspective. So forewarned is forearmed and all that. And I just like to give people the ability to make more informed choices when it comes to what makes them happy or not.
This is probably opening a huge can of worms, but you've done Idiot Brain and Happy Brain. Any idea what the next book will be?
I do have an idea what the next book will be. I'm not allowed to talk about it yet because I think negotiations are still going on. So I think maybe for the third one, I might go a complete curveball. I might just do a book full of recipes or something, or just maybe I'll publish some of my erotic poetry. That'll be a surprise for everyone.
That's Dean Burnett of Cardiff University and The Guardian's Brain Flapping blog. His new book is Happy Brain, Where Happiness Comes From and Why. Dean, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me. Much appreciated.
And that's our show. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.